questions for later this afternoon for the other fellows to be asking. You think now, after the vantage point you have from the inside of 14 months in office, that perhaps you were too optimistic about really changing government, which is a formidable monolith, hard to move, vast bureaucracy. Remember, Jack Kennedy complained that he'd order something that didn't get done. But what's your view about changing things from what you think?
No, let me tell you, while it's still frustrating, and, you know, when you start something, you want to move faster, I have to tell you, and I don't mean to pose as an I told you so, I have to tell you that this was not a surprise.
It was not a surprise.
No, because I could point to a number of times back in the campaign in speeches, any number of them, in which I said and then reiterated that no one should expect a magic wand, that it was going to be a long haul. And as I put it, I said it's taken those that we seek to oppose more than 30 years to get where they've gotten with this government structure. And I said all that we can hope to do is first slow down the toboggan, dig in your heels, and hopefully bring it to a stop and begin the long push back uphill. And when I said that, I was actually speaking of an entire term.
Of 4 years?
Yes.
Before you can measure
that it would yes, that it would take that much. In some respects, I have been gratified by how much has been accomplished.
Could you tell me, what do you think as you look back now? What are your accomplishments in 14 months?
Well, there were things that I said, that I promised, that I would try to do, and never in my own heart, I guess, ever envisioned that that we could have been as successful. I don't mean I could have, that they would have turned out as successfully. For example, I expressed my hope, my intention to try to get for the government appointments, not the kind of people who were seeking jobs in government, but to go out and interest the private community in putting in at least a little time in service for government. Now, I intended to do it, but I never realized that we'd meet with the success. I don't like to say I, because I had a lot of people helping. But what's happened was, even before the election was over, friends and supporters began laying the groundwork for a kind of citizens' committee. And right after the election, they went to work, and virtually full-time, as a kind of screening committee, not to screen applicants for jobs, but I shouldn't even use that word, to be more a recruiting committee. And they went to employers, and of course these were people from all over the state of California who had great knowledge about personnel and men who were experts in their fields. And out of this recruiting came this tremendous group of particularly young men, but not all young, some men who had approached retirement but who were prematurely retired, men like Earl Koch, who's our Secretary of Agriculture. And we batted 100% in getting this kind of staff and personnel. And it's just been fantastic to see the changes in the business-like approach to government, where you had men who were interested in getting a job done and who were the first to come in if they had something that was useless, instead of defending it, were the first to come in and say, hey, we don't need this. You know, wipe this out. This was a surprise. On the task forces, I never dreamed that they would move as effectively and as completely and as fast and come in with something like 1,800 recommendations. And all so sound, and then with this same team that I'm talking about of ours, that literally days, only a few days after the report was received, when I thought now we go into the rest of the year studying and seeing how we can plan this, that the first report I get is that 137 of the recommendations are already in operation, and that another 604 have been approved to put into operations, and that I can put 505 of those into operation without any depending on the legislature, just by my order, which has been given. Well, this moved faster than anything that that I had thought. So in some ways, I'm
Go ahead.
Regret of it. The frustrating thing is the length of time it will take for that to show up, let's say, in such a thing as big and cumbersome and built in as the budget. I can stand up and list millions of dollars, one after the other, in savings and economies that have been made. But when you stop to think that the budget that we've presented to the legislature was being constructed before these economies went into effect. And you can't base a budget on theory. You can't say, we think we're going to be able to save it. You've got to save it and prove it. And then the next budget will reflect what you saved the year before.
I imagine one of your frustrations has been the legislature, and your critics there say that you couldn't get, and this sounds harsh, a Mother's Day resolution through the legislature. Supposing you could get any three bills you wanted through, what bills would they be, Governor?
Right now?
Yes, sir. This year.
Oh, well, of course, I'm shooting in the dark a little bit now because I don't know of the 99 task force recommendations that require legislation. I don't know what the legislation is yet that's been formulated for that. So without knowing what those are, in other words, one of those might take a precedence if I knew what it was.
But is there anything you feel really deeply about that if you could get it through without a great hassle?
Yeah, tax reform.
Tax reform.
Would be one. I suppose I should say the reorganization plan we've submitted, and yet I don't feel that strongly. I want it very much, but we're operating already without it. In other words, the reorganization of the executive branch that I'm asking for, we put into effect on our own and have proven for a year now that it'll work this way.
Well, you mean there really are no bills you would like to get through?
Oh, now wait a minute. I'm just trying to think of all of the things and trying to rate them because I've put them all up there.
Are they really hot?
The tax reform, of course, would be a great number one priority. Jack, you've asked a tough one to answer because I don't know how to establish priorities. We've got a quite comprehensive crime program up there that we tried last year and that...
Well, you got some of that through last year.
We got some. Mm-hmm. We want the rest, and it's vitally important. We want some more flexibility in the area of welfare to do the things that we think are, and not just for economy, but that we think are going to make it possible to break the, what I call, cycle of dependency. To make welfare, see, my goal, my belief is that welfare is off the track unless its stated goal is to make itself unnecessary. Mm-hmm. Welfare should actually be established to put itself out of existence by curing the problem and making the people self-sufficient. Now, you'll never completely achieve it, of course. But I think I don't think on a national level that welfare for many years now has been aiming at such a goal at all. It's not only self-perpetuating, it's growing. It's a thing as if someone has decided that a certain segment of our population is going to be taken care of by government. It's a kind of a redistribution of wealth idea.
Well, do you reject some of the new innovative ideas in this respect? For example, Milton Friedman, who's a conservative economist, who was Barry Goldwater's economics advisor, the negative income tax, where in effect my suggestion, you just fly over Watts and drop $10 bills from a helicopter. You would really do away with the vast welfare bureaucracy. You would do away with the checks and balances, and we could perhaps turn our... I'm being only slightly cynical.
Well, you know, no, the funny thing is, Friedman was being a little bit facetious. Most people in his negative income tax thing haven't realized that he himself kind of had tongue-in-cheek. What he was saying was, all right, if you believe in the individual, give him the money. Just the same as if he was working and earning it himself. Give him the money and then forget about all these medical programs and forget about all these welfare programs. Turn him loose as a private citizen to spend his money as he will. And of course, you know that the vast bureaucracy doesn't have that much faith in the individual anymore. They weren't about to go for such a thing. But he didn't really mean by that.
He was being cynical or
that's right.
Amusing. Or...
He didn't, number one, think it would happen, but he also didn't mean that he believed that the answer to humankind was to put a great segment of your population on a permanent dole. I'm still at your first question there. My problem is one of just of priorities. I hesitate to attach them other than that one. And I put that one up there as such a priority because so many of the things we want to do, we are restricted in doing by the fiscal chaos that we inherited. We've just had a luncheon meeting in there today about our summer youth program, summer jobs for the young people in the state. And we were talking about how much more we could do. Now the bulk of this is going to be provided through enlistment of the private enterprise sector.
Yes.
But even at the state level, how much more could be done if, for example, we had the money to go to, say, forestry, mm-hmm. or parks and recreation, and say to them, look, if you had X million dollars, what are the jobs right now that you'd like to see done? In other words, we're not thinking of it just from the angle of make work for some kids that need jobs. We're talking about jobs that you could say to these kids with a straight face, look, this job needs to be done.
And
we
they
want
can
it
see
done.
It, have the satisfaction of
knowing they're doing
getting
something.
Paid for it.
Yeah. And yet we have to sit here and, yeah. You know, the barrel is empty. And it isn't a vast amount of money. For example, if we had $1 million to hand the forestry department and say, hey, for the fire breaks that need to be built and won't be built because the schedule, you know, we just can't provide it that fast. If you could accelerate it, and then this summer, go on a recruiting drive for all the young kids you could muster and say, we've got the money. Yes. You guys are going up into the hills and cut
fire. There's always a problem with government money. Governor, I was interested, for example, I've heard you in the last weeks speak several times about Watts and about Mr. McClellan's program there. While I would agree with you that it's a very interesting program and it's done some good, it scratches the surface. Now, and I was particularly interested in your repeated remarks that you ought to take people off the top of the barrel. I think the unemployment rate in Watts, according to the last Labor Department spot survey, was 40%. If these vast number of unemployables are allowed to fester in these big city ghettos, are we ever going to change the system? Why can't we do something about the people at the bottom of the barrel, too?
Oh, I don't say that we don't, and this morning in there, I didn't mean to imply that. But my feeling is that there's something wrong with directing all of your effort to going down to the person who is probably never going to be completely free of public assistance. Even if you can make him partly able to take care of himself.
He's disabled by
that's
life
right.
And the situation
yes.
of his life.
While at the same time, you continue to drain away a lot of your resources caring for people who, with a little attention right now, could get out on their own and not only not be draining away your resources, but actually be contributing to helping those others by way of being a self-supporting, tax-paying citizen. And this was the thing. Chad McClellan's program was never intended to be a cure-all.
Of course not. So
it was intended to get this thing done.
It's a beginning program,
yeah.
and I can understand you would like to see some immediate results, and it's one way to do that.
Now, let me tell you where the facts are deceiving, though, the statistics, when they give you statistics about Watts now, so the surface hasn't been scratched. This just isn't true. And it's one of the things why we won't play a numbers game anymore. In other words, if you wanted to say to me, okay, how many people statewide is this program put to work? I can't tell you.
Well, you gave a number this morning.
Well, this was on the Watts feature.
Yes.
And he did that before he ever went to work for the state.
Oh, I see.
In the 16 months after the riots. But let me tell you why industry got its fingers burned on that. They can prove to you. They can show you the employment rules and show you this happened to the people. But immediately, some of the detractors and some of those who don't want this answer to the problem moved in and totaled up the figures in Watts. Well, the thing is, in Watts, they were moving in. you'll never be able to go on that figure because the age dependent children program went up 54% in the first year after the riot. 30% of the people that Chad McClellan's group got jobs for moved out of Watts. So the percentage went down. In other words, proving that the walls of the ghetto are economic. The minute they had a job and a salary, they said, we're getting out of here.
Well, that's not completely true. That's an interesting thing, Governor, because they're not exactly economic. There are other walls. There are the social walls and the walls of prejudice, which are still very real in American life. We all have to...
Not as much in California as you might think. With all of the argument about open housing and so forth,
yes.
We have no restrictive covenants here.
Well,
I'll grant you, you're going to find somebody that won't sell his house.
A good many people who won't. Yeah.
But you also will find that there are less lines that way.
You also had a state that voted 2-1.
I know you probably won't accept this, but it is absolutely true that that vote was on the basis, and many people who had no thought or prejudice themselves, who lived in these kind of neighborhoods, said the constitutional issue of the right of an individual to his property is the thing we're defending here. And that California is better that way. The biggest part of the problem is economic. I don't say we neglect the other part of the problem. But again, let's cure the one that can be cured. What good does it do to pass a law that a door is open to someone if they don't have the price of a ticket? You can have all the open housing laws in the world, but if the fellow still sits there and says there are no houses out there in that suburb that I can afford to buy. Now, we have working right here in the state a commission involving the private sector, involving research people and architects, on trying to find a way that we can develop and build attractive, aesthetically attractive, not barracks type, houses that can go back to the era of selling houses in the $10,000-$12,000 bracket.
Mm-hmm.
And one experiment that's going to give us a big chance is in the Watts area. There's a freeway that has to go through there, the Century Freeway. Now, you'd be surprised, in the so-called slum of Watts, and it isn't a ghetto at all, the high percentage of totally owned homes in the Watts area.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are the people who want to live in this kind of a neighborhood. This is their church, this is their school, these are their friends and relatives, this is where they want to live. Now, up till now, when a freeway went through, the state, paid you the fair market value for your house. But finding yourself some place to live and whether that money would buy you another place to live, that wasn't the state's business. Now we've come to an actual community situation, Watts. And we've got a commission working because of this neighborhood thing that is trying to, and have their eye on several pieces of property, trying to work with the neighborhood leaders in this area to make a transfer. To, in other words, not say to this person, okay, you've had your homes all paid for, here's X thousands of dollars for it, and then let this guy find out, well, where do I move to? Can I buy a comparable living quarters for this amount of money? What we're thinking of is finding enough area, not too far away, that the state will actually buy the area and take care of, connection with private enterprise, putting up the comparable housing, good housing, and literally say to these people, we'll trade you even. Here's your neighborhood transferred, here's this home, or if it's an apartment, or if it's a duplex, we've got a choice of all of these, and you go to the same church and you go to the same school. In other words, we're going to restore your community and trade you even. You don't lose a thing. Now, I think the experiment, I'm very hopeful that it'll work. And if it does, it may establish quite a pattern for future dislocations as freeway building goes on. We're not completely dedicated here that the only function we have is to cut the cost of government. As a matter of fact, we have increased more than 2-1 this year the number of physically handicapped people who have been trained and put into self-sustaining jobs is 69% greater than it was the year before we took office. So, in fact, we were out there when I just gave that award to the Army base. I don't know of an Army base that ever any place got such an award,
for
hiring the physically handicapped. And I was amazed it's not only physically handicapped. I was amazed to discover that at Hamilton Air Force Base, they have also, part of this program, they've employed the mentally.
That's very good. That's a touchy thing. Governor, on another subject, foreign affairs and involvement in Vietnam, I've heard you say, as I've listened to you, that we should end the war, and we end the war by winning it. Could you go into this and spell this out a little, what the consequences are? What do you mean? Because you know the complications of the Vietnam situation as well as I do.
Yes, but I'm in agreement with a number of things. The other day, I'm in agreement with what former President Eisenhower said in the air. I don't think we've turned our full resources to it. I don't believe that we can just simply pack up and move out. I think we're in Vietnam for our own national interest. And I think the people should have been told this. I think it was a mistake to try to pose for a while that this was really only motivated by wanting to do something for a country that asked us for help. It is to our national interest. Now, recently there was a series of interviews, a man who tried to interview the present military leadership and discovered they'd been muzzled and they are not allowed to talk about Vietnam policy. So he then turned to the other group that he could get for an opinion and their views, which were the great group of leaders from World War II, General Eaker and Twining, General Trudeau, and Admiral Burke. A number of admirals and generals, and many of them who would be classified as in the intellectual bracket, the kind who were commandants at West Point and heads of the command and staff school and so forth, who were students of this. And the most fascinating thing was, none of these were privy to what the others were saying. These were individual interviews. And they all came out the same, with the same plan for winning in Vietnam. And number one, everyone's top priority, as we know it has been on the part of the present military leadership, there's no secret of this, for the last 2 years is, close Haiphong. Stop the supplies from coming in that are doing the damage. This was number one. And number two was, almost without exception, in fact, I think without exception, they said invade. That when I say, when I expressed a little doubt there, was because a couple of them did offer an alternative. If not invade, at least keep ever present the threat of invasion. And they pointed out the military ridiculousness of saying to an enemy, you don't even have to keep a pop gun at home. You can send everybody down on the offense into South Vietnam because no one's going to attack you at home. And as one of them said, even if we only just marshaled some landing barges and every once in a while got some shipping together and made it look like an invasion, we could pin 500,000 down up there waiting for it. Hot pursuit, of course. You know, let's quote Mao Zedong. Mao Zedong says that any time that you restrict the flexibility, the ability to move of an army, you have given away your chance for victory. And as long as you've got an enemy, let's say it's like the kids playing a game of tag, and the tree over there is safety. They can't be tagged while they touch the tree. Here's a fella comes across, can shoot the hell out of you, and 5 miles away from the Cambodian border and duck across the border and thumb his nose at you. There's only thing you can do is go after him across that border. And it does no good. Cambodia cannot, and Laos cannot claim neutrality.
You fear the possible consequences.
What would be the consequences? And those countries are the ones who gave away the neutrality. Mm-hmm. We did not invade them.
So speaking of atomic war with the Soviet Union or China,
well, let me ask you, at what point and at what hot spot in the world that we actually think menaces our shores, do we then decide we have to accept that risk? Someplace along the line, aren't we going to have to face the situation of the farmers at Concord Bridge that we're debating as we know they were in history? Did King George really mean to fight, or didn't he? And finally the farmer who said, if they mean to have a war, let it start here. Will we in any way be able to prevent such a thing if at any time it serves the other person's interest, the Soviet interest or the Red Chinese interest, to do this? They're going to do it. Whether there's anything going on in Vietnam or whether we're sitting here celebrating Thanksgiving, they're going to do it when they're and if they're ready. But again, I must say this question also was voiced to these same military people I'm talking about. And I have great respect for their knowledge of their trade, and I don't think they're warmongers. In fact, most of them were pretty strong in their belief in peace and what could be accomplished in peace. But most of them made pretty good cases to point out why this could not and would not happen, particularly in the part of the Soviet. So I feel that I wish you could have been with us Sunday afternoon over at Letterman. I know this isn't a way to win an argument with specifics.
Well, I was with you. I didn't get into the war. Well, I meant I know what you saw.
Yeah.
I know you were touched by it.
Well, and the thing is, every war in history and every lesson of history tells us that...
Very good picture.
Tells us that there's more of this through wars of attrition, through long drawn-out wars, than there is in the sudden thrust. My feeling is that we violated the thing that we learned in World War II. In World War II, if you'll remember, bloody as it was, the American policy was throw anything and everything before you throw human flesh. Firepower and weaponry and steel is a lot cheaper than a human being. And now it seems as if we've reduced this more to the war of, like the old Indian wars and the cavalry. We've handed the fellow his musket and said, okay, go out there in the jungle after him. And I suppose what I'm saying is that I believe that the United States and the American people would feel a lot better about this. And I think we would make a better move for peace in the entire world if the government of the United States would put this country on a war footing and ask the people of the country to sacrifice in some measure to make up for what's going on over there and say, we're going to, not guns and butter, guns come first, and we're going to win this as quickly as possible.
Thank you very much,
Governor. I'm not trying to stop it. I just want to talk a minute without being recorded.
Oh.
At 2 o'clock, as of now, George.